This street I stayed on in Matosinhos, just north of Porto, where the streetcars send seagulls flying, where joggers brush just past longshoremen, where old men drink their coffee on the sidewalk and sigh. I think it's everything I want from Portugal. But the most endearing thing about Brito Capello Street, I think, is the quiet anarchy of the architecture. Hulking blocks of raw concrete on one building, while next to it an aging ballad of stucco and balustrades, and then next to that a deeply Instagrammable old storefront covered in faded aquamarine tile. It's a mix of architectural cucina povera and grand brutalism, all running down to the port where the new cruise terminal looks like a royal cousin of the Guggenheims in Bilbao or New York City. This is a land of architectural giants, home to two Pritzker Prize winners, Eduardo Soto from Porto and Cesar Vieira, who was born right here in Matosinhos, which is, by the way, two more Pritzker Prize winners than New York City has ever brought into the world. I cannot help but think that the obsessions of these Portuguese builders and dreamers are the same stuff that animates the work of today's guest, Ana Aragão, who left her architecture studies to instead draft her own parallel worlds through her artwork. It can be hard to summarize, but I would say she creates drawings, sometimes using nothing fancier than a Bic pen on paper. These range in size from handheld to mural size, but always have an astonishing level of detail, recreating and riffing and recomposing the buildings and the skyline of her city, or of the Tower of Babel, or of other astonishments of architecture, then infusing them with a bit of magical realism, earthquakes, apocalypses, worlds without gravity. Her work is obsessive, like the fevered sculptures in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You see it, and immediately you know an unusual mind lies behind it, and that's why I wanted to crack open a bottle of port wine with Ana, break into that brain a little bit, and see what it says about her and about the city that made her. This final Porto episode, like the rest, was recorded pre-COVID, but the memories are still strong and they are still warm. Thank you especially to Matosinhos, to Tiago Costa, Eduardo Leal, and the Adventure Cinema Festival crew. We will meet again. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you're listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world.
Here I am.
Here you are.
Here I am. This is me.
It's perfect. I didn't know I was going to get a song.
No, I'm terrible at singing. Sometimes I pretend and I say that I'm a singer, but I'm joking. Even when I sing the congratulations song, like the birthday song, I'm terrible.
Really, just like, yes. Bad. I mean, birthday song is supposed to be sung badly. It's right. It's being sung by people who love you, and you know that they love you because they're willing to sing, and they should not sing.
Exactly.
So I like that idea. Okay, so Ana, you have brought no thanks to your husband who got regular wine.
Yes. No proper husband.
You went out and corrected it and brought a port wine, but a fresh port wine.
Yes, because the white port wine should be drunk fresh. That's important. You can also add tonic water, but I think plain is quite good.
That's the way. I can tell with this cork that it's going to make a great sound. So we're going to do a little like ASMR. Alcohol bottle sound. Oh, that's so good. I'm going to put it back. It's just like, it's perfect.
Wow.
I feel like I could start like a sound library and start licensing the sound of the perfect cork. All right. I just opened this bottle 5 times. That's how excited I am about it. Quinta de la Rosa, which is, I'm pronouncing it like in Spanish, which is terrible.
That's great.
It's, this is the, I mean, we're in Porto, Matosinhos, but Porto, and port wine is the drink.
Port wine is the only logical drink I could give you.
I know, and I like how you came in and you're like, you know, my husband didn't get to bring the port wine, but I said, he's an American, he needs a port wine. And it is true, like I, from the beginning of my days, long before I even knew that Porto was a place, Of course you know of port. In like old British gentlemen
exactly.
who drink it.
You don't even think about the city. You think about the wine. So it's very logical that you drink port wine and you present it to someone that's coming from far away.
I'd love
to
that.
Visit us.
Thank you for presenting me with this
Thank
port
you,
wine.
Thank you, Nathan. It's
Cheers.
A pleasure. Cheers.
Pleasure.
Wow. It's sweet, isn't it?
Now, is that sweeter than it usually is?
No.
No.
No, it's normal. They are sweeter. In the store, they had sweeter, but they didn't have fresh, so...
When you say fresh, what does that mean? Is it green
no,
instead
fresh,
of red? Or
no, in the way that it's really fresh, like...
Oh, it's cold.
Cold. Sorry.
I get that. Okay,
in
yes.
In Portuguese, you say fresco for... it's not fresh. No, I was translating like...
Yeah. You know, somebody at the bar, one of the bars last night was like, do you want that beer fresh? And the English here is so good, especially I'm used to Spain, you know. I love you, Castilians. Your English is often pretty shitty. Mm. The English in Portugal is insanely good. And so it was very funny because I had no idea what he was saying. He was like, do you want a fresh beer?
Not fresh because we say, yeah, it's very close.
So you want cold port.
Cold.
But I think of port as like, it's also, there's red and white.
Exactly. There's... the white is my favorite, but the other one is also very, very good. But I'm more a white wine person. So.
Yeah. Hey, me too. And
great.
This is really good. And it's also, it's like, I don't think I've ever had a white port wine before.
Nice.
I don't think that's not, I mean, I think of it as like a big snifter of like heavy, dark red, like very intensely plummy. Kind of wine.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely, it's extra dry. I mean, it's still sweet, but it's pretty great.
Mm-hmm. And you can mix it also with ice and tonic water. It's also nice. This one is also good for that. So
great. That'll be my plan B with the rest of the bottle.
Great idea.
Am I going to make you leave me the bottle? What am I going to do with an
of
entire
course,
bottle?
Of course, it's for you. I wanted to choose properly, but...
Thanks to your husband, you had to
take
what was available.
Yes, and run to the store like a crazy person, but that's my normal way of living.
Yeah, that's when you're most comfortable, when you have an urgent errand, something to do.
No, we Portuguese, that's a characteristic we do have. You probably do have to, but Portuguese people are used to... There's a Portuguese word that I cannot translate. It's called desenrascar. Desenrascar is like you have to arrange a method at time and with great imagination. It's true. It's true.
All of that in one word?
Yes, all that in one word. The word in Portuguese is quite funny. But we do have that characteristic. For example, I studied in a German school. If you ask a German person to solve something in 5 minutes of the problem having to be solved, they will panic. We don't panic. We live that way consistently. We solve things 5 minutes before it's done. It's like
always improvising.
Always
finding
a way. It's improvising, but it's funnier. But it's like improvising.
But funny, all right. People, you're just going to have to believe on that. That word is like improvising, but funnier. I know, I think Eduardo was telling me something. He's like, Eduardo Leal, who was on the show, who's a friend of your husband's also, but he was saying like, I don't know, the Portuguese word is just better. It's like, I can't translate it, I don't want to. It's like, so I feel like there are those things. Some words, they're just going to be funnier, Portuguese.
Yes.
How did you go to a German school? Was that here in Porto?
Yes, it was in Porto. It has no apparent reason besides from my mother having also studied there.
Ah, okay.
So she studied in German school because maybe it was close to home. And then she put me and my brother there. And it was good because I still don't understand Portuguese people working. I still don't. And I work in Portugal since forever, since like 10 years, since I've been working. And I do not understand Portuguese people working. working.
Like the work style of Portuguese people?
Yes.
Because the Germans taught you the meaning of work.
Yeah, the meaning of time and schedule and like is two, three it's three, four it's four. But in Portugal, no, that's very flexible. It's like liquid. The time is liquid. It's like two, but it can be three, and then it can be four, and it can be tomorrow. Everything can be arranged. It's like
that's amazing. I'd noticed you broke off a very appropriate sounding genau. So obviously you have the German skills, but the thing that really sticks with you is this appreciation of the value of punctuality.
I'm a bit freak.
Yeah, the Pünktlichkeit, that is like it's one of the defining characteristics of the people. And you know, there's a dark side to the German obsessions with efficiency, but it is. I sometimes resent it here in Southern Europe. I remember going to Cefalù in Sicily, right around the time the Germans were making absolutely insane demands on all the Southern European countries, you know, and just being like very German about it and kind of jerks, like we're, you know, demanding austerity, insane measures and all this stuff. And yet Cefalù was just full of Germans who were trying to like get a little bit of that sun, a little bit of that Southern, you know, mentality, like trying to relax, trying to get out of their skin a little bit. And I thought you can't have both, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't come here and just eat ice cream all day and lay out on the beach and enjoy the tremendous love and hospitality of Southern Europe. And then when it's time for the loan to come due, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
But it is a remarkable kaleidoscope that is this continent. And have you lived outside of Portugal, or have you always been here?
Almost never. Like 1 year in Barcelona, I did Erasmus there. It was an amazing year, and I loved the city, of course. Besides from that, I've always lived in Porto, so I'm really from here, very Portuense.
Portuense. And how do you feel about, I mean, so many of the people that I have met here, even in Matosinhos, and like have spent huge amounts of time or are still actually living abroad. What is it like to be someone who stays and you're young and talented and ambitious and loved, and like you can go and work anywhere and do, you know, anything you want to do, and yet here you are staying in Porto?
It's true. It's a question that I've asked myself, because, for example, my brother has emigrated. He lives in Germany. The sister of my everyone is abroad, basically. Right. A lot of my friends, a lot of architects. I'm an architect of education. Mm-hmm. A lot of architects, a lot of my friends are abroad, because in Portugal, although it is a great country, and it has so many qualities, but in terms of your work being recognized properly, in terms of value, in terms of living costs and everything, for young people, it is not that easy. We are not well paid, etc. It's not that easy. So, of course, you have much better opportunities abroad. So I kind of decided it, but it's not a decision. I think most important things you don't decide. It's like my work. I didn't decide to become an illustrator or an artist, an architect. I just kind of stayed in the path, and it started to make sense. So to stay here, it's also a question of pride and a question of challenge. I like challenges, so I think it's a challenge.
And what's the pride? Just pride in being Portuense, pride in staying here.
It's like your heritage stays with you, and in my case, of course, I don't have any pretension of representing a city, but I do representation, so it's funny because you can joke with that.
You actually represent the city.
I actually represent the city, not yes. In the way that the mayor represents the city, but right. I do represent the city.
You create representations.
Exactly.
Yep.
And I think it's important to have a place, to have a center. My husband, for example, he travels a lot. He travels almost the whole year, and I stay here most of the time. I love to travel, but he travels more than me. And I think it's important to have a center, and I never felt like that, but I don't exclude the idea of going abroad because my works are site-specific almost. With the passing of time, knowing me better, I understand that I cannot do some piece that is abstract. Okay, I have one or two pieces that are abstract in the way that they are almost universal, like my Babel Tower that I put now in Lisbon. But the rest of the time, I do a work for a place. And that is why it is so important to have a center, but then to go to the places and understand them and to feel the place. I did a work like that last year in Macau, and it was amazing because I was there. I had to live there to understand it and then to produce a piece. So
it can happen. Like, you can assume the identity of someone who's looking at some place that's quite dissimilar, like Macau, mm-hmm. And then create art based on what you see in the city that kind of unfolds in front of you. But it's not something that you can just sort of do. I don't know. I mean, we had mentioned JR before we started recording. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of like very well known and very kind of well marketed kind of street artist. But he does installations everywhere. He's like, you know, Banksy. It could just be at any point in any, you know, on the U.S.-Mexico border and the West Bank and the Louvre. It doesn't matter. For you, you have to have a root in a place before you start to do a project there.
Yes, it's very important to understand the place because I'm an architect. And I'm an architect from Porto. Again, I'm sorry for, I'm making a lot of publicity to my city, but it's not publicity. Because my education...
By the way, that's why we're here.
Cool.
That's great.
No, but my education, I studied architecture here in Porto. In the Porto University, the faculty of Porto. And this is the university where César Vieira and Fernando, before him, Fernando Távora, and after César, Souto de Moura. They are three major architects. And they are really, really important marks worldwide. Mm. They are, you cannot study architecture without studying them. Especially César Vieira.
And these are local Portuguese architects trained.
Exactly, in Porto. And their philosophy, and that's very beautiful, and that's why I think I work like I work. Their philosophy, if you can call it like in Porto we call, in the university, they call it method. Their method is to feel the place, to understand the place, to go there. Like César Vieira did a building in Berlin, and the critics say he was a Berliner. He did a work in Manhattan. They say he was a New Yorker. So that's how I learned. That's why I am like that. I need to feel the place to understand the place. And I cannot, for example, I love maps and I do mental maps. But I cannot put something that's in the north, in the south, and something that's on the west, in the west, because it doesn't make sense for me. So although it's mental, it's not, it has to have some organization. It has to have some relation to the real geography. It's not only imagined geography. It has to relate to what I see, what I understand, what I study. So
in your funny. Art, Matosinhos, a northern suburb, would never be south of Porto. It's just like the world could not exist that way in your work.
Matosinhos, for me, it's also Porto. Of course, it's Matosinhos. It's a different place, but it belongs to Porto. It belongs here. I've always also lived here. I had a lot of friends living here, so it's part of the spirit.
I have to say that it's not something surprising to me, but also makes a lot of sense for you to say that there's kind of like three world-class architects who would come out of Porto's architecture program at the university, because and I don't know if I'm making that connection, but the past 2 days, just walking around, whether Central Porto or here, even on you know, this street, Rua Brito Capel, which is like, the architecture is insane. It's so interesting. It's so different. Like, and it's so strong, and like, just the I just was constantly pulling the phone out, and you know, and Matt kind of walking with me, even more so. Here's a building with pink tiles that look like they're lining an oven on the outside. Here's like a brutalist, like a really intense structure that feels like the facade would be, you know, at home in Romania, you know, like, and it's really, it's Matosinhos is pretty gritty on some level from an architectural sense, but it's so fascinating. And I don't even know why, like, I have no understanding of what's happening, but it sounds, it seems like this is something that is a really deep part of the identity of this town. I don't know if that's true of the rest of Portugal, but.
Yes, and you have also here the Casa de Arquitetura, it's the home, the house of architecture. It's very, very near. It's like very near of where we are. And the house of Caesar also, some houses of him. So the and the theory about architecture is also very strong here. So we have a heritage, we that studied here in Porto, we really have a heritage that's really strong, I should assume there. And it's interesting because there's a certain rivalry, probably you've feel that, you've sensed that between Porto and Lisbon.
Mm-hmm. There's a rivalry between the two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant.
That is true.
Yes.
People keep telling me to, you know, that Porto is the best city, and yeah, it's the second city.
Nah,
and
both are amazing. Both are really amazing. Of course, the affectionates, the arguments are always partial.
Fair.
But in terms of architecture, we really have the masters.
Yeah.
So the heritage here is very strong.
And it seems very like pastiche in some way, like the amount of different styles. And, you know, I come from a town, I grew up in Key West, where there's a preservation board that ensures that every building is built the exact same way. They're almost like Hasids, like they've decided like this is the look that we're going to have forever. And it's from the same era, like 1870s, like a wooden Victorian, you know, kind of style house. It's the only thing we're going to build. It's so incredible and kind of confounding and challenging and awesome to be in a place where these styles seem like right next to each other.
Yes, but that's also due to some or badly or bad organized urban politics. And here in Portugal, if you go to outside the centers, you see really very not well done buildings. And that's a shame, because we really have very, very good people.
Like if you had better zoning, then it would be more straightforward. But there's a balance, right? Because you don't want people building like an 80 story building in a residential neighborhood or whatever, you know. Zoning laws exist for a reason, mm-hmm. but they can become very oppressive very quickly.
You have to decide, it's like persons, it's like people. Like, you can love very beautiful and like equal people to each other, like models, they are so pretty and the same. And you can love people that are different. Like, I think it's like life. You just, that's a contradiction that will exist forever, and you'll never get a real good balance between that.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
How did you move from architecture to art?
Good question. I had a moment when I decided. I remember it perfectly. It was very nice because it was a moment like this one. I was having a glass of wine and a great lunch with some friends. I was doing the PhD in architecture at that time. And I shared some drawings in internet. I'm terrible with internet and those things. But I shared some things and people started to like and share and wanting to buy it. And I had a newspaper publishing my work. And I was with some friends with a company that wanted me to do the work. And
this was like a one-off newspaper article about your art, or you had a regular feature?
It was one time.
Like
it
a
was
profile like, of you
exactly,
as an artist.
Exactly, profile.
Yeah.
And that somehow resonated in a bigger way than I thought. And a friend of mine, it was very fun because I remember it perfectly. He's still a friend, and now he lives in America, precisely. And he asked me, and I told him, I have to finish my PhD first. And he asked me, why do you have to finish your PhD? And that question was like crucial for me.
Right.
I was, why do I? Good question. I got home and I said I still lived with my mother and grandmother, and I said, I'm going to quit the PhD. I know I have a scholarship, but I will quit. And I'll start drawing and try to live from it. And they were like, my grandmother was like, nah, that's not a good idea. My mother was like, okay, you can do whatever you want. Probably super afraid, but...
Right. But they were willing to let go of the dream of Dr. Aragao.
Yeah. And now I have the greatest idea ever for the PhD. Really, I have the great idea.
Yes.
I could explain you, but it would take longer.
You just said you have the greatest idea ever.
It's amazing. It has to be. It has to do. I can explain it like in large.
Definitely, please.
Yes.
Yes. The greatest idea ever.
The greatest idea ever is to do a PhD based on drawing. Of course, because I do drawing, and the University of Porto and the faculty, they defend drawing as the method. Ta-da! It's like the most important thing ever if you draw by hand. But I tried to do a PhD that was based on drawing, and they were like, we prefer theory. But now I think I have more arguments because I've worked for like 7 years now in drawing.
Yeah.
And what I've done, it's research, and it's real and true, and I think valid research about cities. So I have more arguments now.
So it's a doctorate of drawing.
Yes.
I love that idea.
Based on drawing.
And that goes beyond an MFA or, you know, just fine arts. You will earn your doctor credentials as someone with a pen in hand.
I would love that. And you, of course, I love theory. I'm a very theoretical person. I'm always reading. When I write a text, it has like 100 footnotes. But I think that would be a great challenge for me. Just to write would be amazing, but to draw. And I would love to imagine, that's my challenge, to imagine Porto. But I have to convince, I don't have to convince anyone, I just have to exhibit it then. To imagine Porto, what if, my question normally when I start something is, what if Guimarães was a city that, da, 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 da. What if Lisbon had another earthquake and da, 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 da. So that's my question, and I would like to do it systematically for Porto. And what if the projects that were never built were in fact built? What would they look like now?
Amazing. So taking all of these mothballed architectural projects and imagining them as, you know, kind of longstanding residents
exactly.
in the city skyline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The transformations that the city suffers, everything. Like, I think that could be amazing. There's Piranesi is one of my, Giovanni Battista Piranesi, he was like a master in drawing, also an architect, trained architect, Italian. He's like my master. He's dead, but I love him anyway.
Some of the best people are dead. That's very true.
It's true. So he has like imaginary drawings of real places. So that's very, very beautiful. And I would like to follow his steps in a contemporary way, of course.
But you'll be doing real drawings of imagined timelines, like alternate timelines.
Yes. Alternate futures. It's alternate like an alternate. Yeah, exactly. It's like alternate future. If that would have happened, what would we see now?
I mean, it's so it's truly fascinating to me. And your work, there's something about it that I mean, as you can tell, even from my sort of tongue twisted description of the architecture, these are not waters that I swim in a lot, like, you know, kind of architecture especially, but even drawing. There's something about your work that just cuts through whatever lack of knowledge I might have, because it's so understandable as an act, you know. It is drawing, and you you draw with like a Bic pen sometimes, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
All the time, or like
not all the time. Lately, I've been drawing more with a Bic pen because it allows you a bigger realism. That's interesting. Like, I love. Do you know Jorge Luis Borges?
Yeah.
The writer.
Yeah.
I love his writing because I think he and other people, but he can give some realness to fiction. I don't know if you can say it like that, but he can make fiction somehow believable. And my Bic pen allows me that, to give some realism to the fiction, to fiction, to my imagined buildings and structures and architectures.
And if you used more sort of refined or exquisite tools, you think it would just add to the artifice? It would be less real.
It's less real, but I also do use other regular black ball pens.
When we're talking about in the art world, that also is not incredibly fancy, right? It's just that's the kind of quotidian, and I say it like it's folk art, but it's not, because even though you're using a Bic pen, you're creating something that's so intense and so elaborate and obviously the product of such, you know, obsession.
Mm-hmm.
It's this completely enchanting combination of approachable, in the sense of like everyone has drawn at some point with a pen, and absolutely fantastically alien, unapproachable, because it's at a level and it's creating a depth and an intricacy that is immediately recognizable as some like next level thing that you're doing. It's an odd combination. It's striking.
Thank you very much. I don't deserve those words, but it is truly amazing to do that, because sometimes I have no idea if I'm going to be able to finish it because of that obsession, because of that intricacy. Sometimes the last work I did, I'm presenting it now in the festival, Vils Festival in Lisbon. The last work I did, I just spent, I have no idea of time, but like 6, 7, 8 months around the same piece. And I was doing it for nothing. That's the funny thing. I was doing it for the sake of doing it, because I just felt I had to do another Babel Tower. I sometimes draw a Babel Tower because it's one of my obsessions, because it's the most amazing myth of the city. So it's really important, of course. And I'm trying to somehow go back to some images that are part of our common imaginary. Everyone knows Brugge's Babel Tower, I think, or has seen it, has imagined it. Everyone has seen some others. So I'm interested in exploring those common imaginary places and pictures, but bringing them to contemporaneity, to our days, and to rethink it.
So describe for me what the Babel Tower is like. What is the form?
It's the original drawing is 2 meters by 1.60. that for a drawing is quite big. For a pen drawing, it's quite big. And it's interesting.
And this was your original or Brugge's?
This was my, like, you look at the drawing and the shape is exactly like the original one made from Brugge. But I just transformed the content. Everything is different. The houses are being destroyed because of the war sceneries that we see in the news. The materials are all different. You have written words in the walls, on the walls that say, for example, fake empires that I love from the National, or they say, realismo mágico or magical realism, and I cut the magical and I write tragical, for example. So you have so many things that I added to that.
And this is Bruegel's, but just in updated
a
for
bit
the modern.
Dark, yeah. Yes, a bit darker.
And it does feel that way. It's like, I don't know, have you seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
No.
This is the seminal kind of, at least in our childhood, movie about people who are visited by aliens, and the way that they kind of express what had happened to them was they, and the way that they were marked and marked for each other, was that they were building similar structures. And they just like kept, and it was like this thing where they just couldn't stop. And it was like, it's eerie and it's fascinating. And it's an act of creativity. They're creating these kind of structures. And it's also, you know, it doesn't let them be. And it feels like that's like when you keep coming back to a theme, to something like the Tower of Babel, you mm-hmm. know, and you're just like continue to revisit and update and like create a new version.
Yes. I have like, now I have three. The first one was very neat, very clean, very calm. The last one is like just crazy information, dark. You have to see it because it went to a mural, a very big mural of 7 meters or 3 and something.
This is one in Lisbon at the Fields Festival.
Yes, the one, yeah. And it's just amazing. It was such a challenge to finish it because you have to have a discipline. It's not that easy to have that discipline. I'm a very disciplined person, but even so,
thanks to the Germans and their
exactly
German school.
Exactly, thanks to the Germans. The Germans.
The Germans have taught me the value of work. But it's true. It does feel like that motor that you have is not. It's not an inquisitive. You know, you're not sort of daydreaming in a. You know.
No, waiting for inspiration for to come. No, it's like discipline. Work hard, like work and start and then finish. Because I believe that the best... I don't really believe in inspiration in the way that we understand it. Because a lot of people tell me that. You need to be inspired to work, don't you? No, like you don't need to be inspired because we all have to work somehow or... Almost everybody has to work. I do, because I have to pay the bills and etc. like normal people. And I believe that you find in another plan, but I think you find the solutions for your problems working and searching and not only thinking. I think a lot and I make like 100 plans for an exhibition, for example. I really do. Every day for like 2 or 3 months, I'm having new ideas. And then I find the solution when I start to do it, right. And I repeat, and then I do it again, and then I do it again, and then somehow I find the solution. It's not only by thinking, it's by doing.
It's amazing, and it's so, so needed, and I wish I could bottle that energy to just... you know, deliver it to like young writers or something, right? And it reminds me, I was talking today about one of my journalistic heroes, this guy, Paul Ford in New York, who writes these amazing essays about the creative process and about a lot of things, but he always had this phrase about editors who ship. And, you know, there's so much of writing that involves people sort of wallowing in their own indecision. And you know, I'm as guilty as anyone of this, of just sort of like waiting for creativity to strike. Meanwhile, Paul wrote this incredibly insightful essay about, you know, the thing that really matters, like the actual value of an editor in our world is somebody who just ships. You get the piece into the world. You just do, you know. Mm-hmm. As Muthoni Drummer Queen said in Nairobi, it's like she has a bias for doing. And I just found that like incredibly inspiring, and that way of like you're saying like I'm going to sit down and I'm going to mm-hmm. accomplish. And I wonder if your art wears its effort on its sleeve, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like people, it's intimidating. It's mind blowing when you see one of your pieces. Again, the creative vision behind it exists. But the first thing to me that is most apparent is like the energy and the effort and the life force that went into this. And is that on purpose? Like,
yes, in a way. Until now it has been, because it's funny. There are two kinds of people, and there are two ways of saying it. So the first one is Peter Cook. He's one of my heroes. He did drawings in the 60s for Archigram. It was a group of English guys that were architects that were exploring the possibilities of futuristic architecture, and they did this amazing drawings. And Peter Cook talks about two different kinds of people, the ones that look at drawings and the ones that assume they are there. And I was telling a friend of mine, it's so funny because I spend like, for example, 5 months doing a drawing, and people look at it like 1 second or two or 5 minutes at most, and then just look away. It's okay. They don't have to look like I do. But I don't talk about me. It's like talking about generally. We are not used to looking at images, of course, because we just scroll images. It's very easy. It's very fast. Nowadays, we don't have those silent moments where we can just appreciate something that had a lot of effort. The second thought I was thinking when you were talking about it was, I showed my drawings to one of the galleries I like here in Porto, and I would like to be, probably I would like to be there, I'm not sure. I changed my mind a lot.
It's your right, okay.
And the guy said to me, okay, this is great, when I showed him the drawings. This is great. This is like you have it all. Now just do bigger things and canvas. And I was like, no, like you're not understanding. This is the work itself. It's not a preparatory thing.
This is not a blueprint for something that you'll exactly. take large.
It's not, the canvas has more value than the drawing. Oh my God, like, yeah. Are we in third grade? No. And there are those people that look at things and just don't understand the value it has. Sometimes I do it purposely. Like, if you think of a painting that's all blue, like Rothko, for example, yep. He's like genius. I don't believe it took less than mine to do. Mm. It's just a different approach.
So even though obviously with Rothko and a lot of that style of art, a lot of people complain about the lack of perceived effort, right? Mm-hmm. Or perceived lack of effort where they're like, it just painted the canvas blue or something, you know. Mm-hmm. You have a completely oppositional approach, but when you look at Rothko, you see the intricacy or the thought and the obsession that you put into your work as well.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think, yes, the visual is only a metaphor for the whatever you think, for the thoughts. So in my case, I just make it more apparent to your eyes. But it's almost an excuse. It's almost a pretext. It's almost a capricho. How do you say it?
Caprice.
Yes. It's something
capricious.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's something almost egocentrical, because maybe in 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 years, I won't be doing that. I have no idea. Now I'm doing that because that's what I feel I have to do. It's but very strange.
You feel it with an urgency, yes. I think, that doesn't feel you know, temporary.
No. It's terrible. Every day, not every day, but yes, every 2 days I say, I will get a job. Now I'm quitting. I will get a job like normal people. This is very difficult. But then I laugh and I say, no, unfortunately, this is my destiny. This is my fate.
Right.
And I know this will last forever because it's really my obsession, because I do something and then I see the errors and then I have to do it again and then yeah. I see the errors and then I have to do it again.
I'm trying to imagine you in like a corporate boardroom at some sort of mid-level, you know, management meeting, just doing the most amazing doodles on your paper, and everybody has left the boardroom meeting and you're still just like working it out, and you're just
that's
like,
how I it started yeah. Not in a company, but in the PhD classes.
And you were just making these exquisite, extraordinary doodles during class or
yes,
something?
Yes, and
that's so crazy.
That's how it started. It's true. I was in the classes. Some of them were really boring and I was feeling sleepy and I was just doing the doodles. Like you say, they were really doodles. And my colleagues started to pay attention and told me, wow, Anna, that's nice. Why don't you exhibit them? And I was like, huh? I'm just doing this for time to pass.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's like a superhero story or something. It's like someone who doesn't know her own powers, you know, like all of a sudden you're melting walls with your eyes or something, you know, but it's like, I haven't seen those doodles. I can imagine they were fucking amazing.
No, you probably
thought they were just like, oh, this is what everybody does when yes. they're bored in class. Yes, and yes. it turns out, of course, that
this
was like...
That's how it started. It's really, my colleagues, they are all my friends. And we remember that time with great, not love, but soldat. Do you know?
Soldat.
Has anyone told you soldat, about soldat? No?
No.
No, so you're not with the bright Portuguese people.
All right, everybody's on blast. Who's been leading me around the last couple of days? You morons, tell me about soldat.
Soldat is just the most important word, Portuguese word, that you'll ever learn. So that is in German, Sehnsucht.
Ah, okay.
All Portuguese people say that saudade is only a Portuguese word. That's how we want to present it. Because it has to do maybe with our descobrimentos, with our discoveries. We discovered the world in
yeah,
theory.
Yeah.
And saudade has that feeling related to the sea and with the ships that sailed away, and we didn't know if the men were coming back or not. It has to do with fado, Portuguese music that's very intense and very sentimental too. So saudade is just the most important word that you'll ever learn.
That is the core essence of the Portuguese soul,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and I cannot believe that nobody has talked
no.
about it with me. Disaster.
Disaster.
since we are here drinking port wine and we're in Matosinhos, which is very near Porto, like, tell me something about the city that inspires you in the work that you do, because it is, as you had said very well before, it's like very specific to this place. You're very connected to it. What should people know about Porto that you know, kind of finds life in your art?
Porto is very, we have a great hospitality, I would say, and that's very special because we have that also to each other. It's very friendly and it is very intricate. It's very dense. It's very typical and it's still very local in the way that the center is still local. I hope the politics understand that, and I'm sure they will. Hopefully.
You're making a face like maybe they won't.
Yes.
But ultimately, you know, we've talked about like Ribeira, like being, you know, overrun by tourists and so on, but you still feel, you feel the small alleys, the dense local.
And I work in the center. I work in the center and I still feel that. And for me, that's the soul of a city, the people that live in it, of course, and the way we treat each other. We are still very friendly with each other. I don't feel that so strongly, for example, in the capital, because of course it's a bigger city, of course it's the capital, it's a bit different, although it's an amazing city, it's very, very beautiful, and the light of Lisbon is just magical. Here in Porto, we don't have that light, but we have a mystery, we have another mystery. So if you walk at night, for example, alone, it's still okay. We are very cheerful, we are bright people, and for me that's the most important thing about Porto. We are, generally speaking, of course, but we are nice people, we are open people, we are very honest, we say the truth.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I have seen more kissing in the last 3 days than maybe I've seen in years. And it's like every time I'm talking to someone, it's like an invitation for, you know, all of the Portuguese who are near, everybody from Matosinho or if we're in the center, to just come and kiss the person I'm talking to.
Yes.
Just
yes.
Be like, hi.
Now when we hug, yeah, we hug, we kiss, and everything.
It's incredible. It's just like, you know, Porto is one giant cuddle puddle that I can tell. You know, it's just like mm-hmm. people are so kind to each other and they're so nice and like everybody feels really validated and
yes.
And there's, you know, this wonderful wine. It is a little, it's Elysian. It's like it's paradisical. You know, it's just like that's existence as it should be. You know, just kind of kisses and wine. Like, please, like
yes, let's go there. Yeah.
How does Porto live in your work in a way that if you had been born in Lisbon or, you know, God forbid, another country, like, how is it specific to this place?
I would say the organization and the confusion that you feel in my work, where of course you have some rationality, but everything's quite confused, everything's quite obsolete, or the time has passed through the buildings, for example, and that's that you feel that in my work. So everything has a bit of Porto.
There's like decay and
decay, exactly.
And there's the gray layer. Yes. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yes, and more than in the beginning. Now I'm feeling that I'm going towards that. A lot of people love my initial work. It was more naive. Now I'm beginning to be a bit more darker. People look at my Babel Tower and say, wow, this is Game of Thrones, and I never saw a Game of Thrones. Or they say, they say a lot of movies that I've never seen. Terrible, but people relate to a darker side, and I like that. I'm comfortable.
Well, it's coming at a time also where Porto is renovating itself in the center, where they're, you know, power washing the walls of old buildings, and that, like, that film that, you know, I think it was Eduardo who's making the comparisons to Havana. Imagine if they went through and just repainted every building in Old Havana. it wouldn't be the same. You would lose an international treasure, you know, a global gem of beautiful decay.
And I hope that economic reasons don't accelerate this gentrification that's happening in the center, because I don't know if foreigners can understand, but we really cannot afford the rents that are being practiced for young people that don't earn that much to live in the center. I'm not talking the center, I'm talking near here in Matosinhos or so. So it's important, it would be really important that political and economic power could understand that, because we are the soul of the city. Not, of course, we love tourists, but they are not the soul of the city. And if tourists come here and they only meet tourists, that's not very interesting. Then we will be a resort, not a city. So
it is the dark cloud that is gathering for so many of us, right?
I
know why your work is making this turn, but it feels like really vital, you know, like really important to communicate and express and pass on the urgency of those questions. Like, this is the city that is your muse, and like it has a path that, you know, that is turning badly. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, maybe that's your job. I know you're not looking at it as you're saying you're not an artist, but you're an artist, and your job is to communicate these great, you know, these kind of like gathering dreads, mm-hmm. in a way that people can't do.
And I think it's very important that you understand how the future could be to take decisions now. So I see my work as sometimes as some, it's not a warning, but it's somehow like a premonition, like, look, this could happen this way. So try to think if you want it this way or another way, or let's imagine what could be. And it's very important that we keep our imagination alive, like what could be. If not, we're just automats repeating ourselves.
I did, you know, when I this word kept popping up when I was kind of going through your piece of art, which now I feel like I haven't spent enough time like on each one, or I need to see it in person to get the full 2 meters, but it felt oracular, you know, like an oracle.
Okay.
Right? You know, it's like you're throwing bones in the fire, mm-hmm. and you're seeing some truth that is like a vision, but it's still like very true on some level. And that's I guess the power of it is just like, people need to imagine how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. What will this city look like if,
yes,
all the projects had been built that had been mothballed, and if an earthquake hits Lisbon? Mm-hmm. It's such a pleasure to hear you talk about that process, because as anyone will see if they go and look at your art in person or online, there's a power behind it, like a motor there that it's so cool to just be able to look under the hood and hear from you how it goes. Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you.
So amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Alexa Van Sickle is our producer. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. One of the great pleasures of my days in Porto was the company of those R&K comrades, Alexa and Matt. No two finer people to share Francesinha's with over deep buckets of beer. Next week, the trip heads to Montreal. Starting with the radio voice of Le Québec Maintenant, the journalist and columnist Patrick Lagacé. It's going to be a great 5 weeks in Quebec with writers and singers and French Canadians and Anglophones and Cree activists and Mohawk cooks. On y va. We will meet you there.